Okay, today we've got Charlie Braco with us. Charlie's at his home in the DC area. We've also got Hannah Goldman in Brooklyn and Debbie Goldman in DC as well. So Charlie, as the Vice President of the National Association of Broadcast Engineers and Technicians, President of that, Vice President of CWA. Charlie, thanks for agreeing to do this. Today is July 2nd, 2024, and it's a little after 1 in the afternoon. Okay.
Thank you for inviting me, and I'm happy to help out and contribute to whatever I can to the project. So thanks.
We really appreciate you doing this. I think it's important for us to capture as much of CWA's history as we can, and this is a great way to do it. And it's been a lot of fun for us as well. So there's a selfish motivation to this too. So
Sure.
Charlie, let's start off. Talk about your childhood. Where were you born and when? And talk a little bit about that.
Thanks, Jeff. Born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, back in 1957. So I'll be 67 years old in October. And had a had a great childhood and upbringing on the southwest side of Chicago. White Sox fan.
I'll be
And
watching the White Sox play the Guardians tomorrow night.
okay. Are you going to be at the game or just on
I
television?
will be at the game.
Okay. Well, good luck to the Guardians.
Thank you. I think the White Sox have cashed in the season already.
Yeah, I think so. But anyway, born and raised and lived all my life in Chicago until about 8 years ago when I relocated to DC. I went to college originally on a track for pre-med or research biology and shifted toward photography and broadcast television when I became interested in those two. I was going to minor in them, but I became so excited with television studios and the technology behind broadcast television that I changed my major and made that my career. And so in 1979, I started working for ABC Television in Chicago. As a requirement of being a technical engineer, we needed to join the union. The union at that time was NABET, NABET, the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians. And NABET was a standalone union at that time in 1979 and 1980. So I joined and became a happy dues-paying member and enjoyed all the benefits of the collective bargaining agreement and the many protections and benefits that the union offered. I was approached about 8 or 10 years into my career by a couple of the union leaders who asked me to, if I wanted to get involved with the union at a low level, become a steward or an alternate steward. I had some very limited experience with that when I worked for the Postal Service. I was an alternate steward in my shop working for the United States Postal Service, but didn't have a really broad base of experience. It was very low level, very introductory. But in any case, I was approached by some of my colleagues at ABC who were active in the union, and asked me if I wanted to become a shop steward. I kind of reluctantly said yes because I was newly married and just starting a family and pretty busy with my career and my home life. But I knew the union had been good to me, and so I wanted to give something a little something back by becoming an alternate steward. So I served in that capacity for a few years, and then,
Okay, let me put the brakes on you because we're going to go way back. I'm going to put the train in reverse a little bit here. Talk about your education growing up. I mean, public school, parochial school. What was your schooling like?
thank you. Sorry if I skipped over that.
No, no,
Raised
no. It's fine.
Roman Catholic on the southwest side of Chicago, and so Chicago, you're identified by a couple of things, territory and regional, obviously north side, south side for the baseball teams, but on a more granular level, if you're raised Roman Catholic in the Chicago metro area, you tend to associate with the parish that you grew up in. Otherwise, if you're of a different faith or not faith-based, you often identify with the neighborhood or the park, Gage Park, Humboldt Park, Lincoln Park, different areas, geographical areas of the city. But I was raised on the southwest side in a parish named Little Flower. It was a Catholic parish, and they had grade school, junior high, and high school. So my educational background was based in my parish school. 8 years of grade school at Little Flower Parish, and then high school. And midway through high school, the archdiocese made the decision to close that particular high school, and so I transferred to Marist High School, which is a Jesuit all boys school on the southwest side, and finished my high school period, and then went on to college at St. Xavier's College, a Catholic college on the southwest side of Chicago. And as I indicated earlier, my original interest was in biology and medicine and science. But when I got hooked on photography and television production and electronic media, I changed and I transferred to Columbia College, Chicago. And that's where I got my degree in broadcast communications.
And what did your parents do for a living?
My mom was a homemaker and raised our family, and my father was a court reporter, although not the typical court reporter in the courtroom with stenography. He had a private business and did a lot of affidavits and interviews and legal work for insurance companies and private law firms. So he would go out in the field and record, testimony and affidavits and that sort of thing. So he had his own private business.
Siblings?
One sister, 3 years younger, and she had much the same background in the Catholic schools. She went on to work for Oprah Winfrey's company, Harpo Productions, originally as a tape librarian, and then she graduated and was promoted to the human resources department, and ultimately finished her career with Harpo Productions as the vice president of human resources for Oprah's parent company, Harpo.
Wow. So you both migrated into broadcast communications of one form or another. That's remarkable. So did she, was it, she looked up to her big brother? Is that what drove her there?
She did, yeah. She had started a family also in the early 80s, and she was working for an apartment complex as a leasing manager. And honestly, she called me one day and said, I can't take this job anymore. I'm through with apartment leasing. If I have to do this one more week, I'm going to pull my hair out. Is there anything in television at all that you can refer me to?" She had taken a couple of courses in radio production at Columbia College, but never finished because she was starting a family and the load was too much. So she had a little bit of exposure to radio broadcast, but never finished her degree. And so she called me and said, "Is there anything you can find for me in television anywhere?" And I said, "Let me make a couple of phone calls." Oprah and her team had just left. They used to produce the show at our television station at ABC in Chicago, but Oprah had moved her operation. She bought her own studio complex on the west side of Chicago and decided to move her operation to the new studio so she could have more control. So they really picked up and moved the entire operation wholesale to a new facility, and then they were looking to staff up. And so the timing was good for my sister because she had it with the apartment leasing, and she called me and I said, "Well, let me see if I can do something for you." So I made a phone call and got her an interview, and then they liked what they saw. They appreciated what she had to offer, and they hired her. And then the rest of her career track was really all on her own. She impressed all the right people and checked all the right boxes, and had a very successful 30-year career with Harpo.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
That's a good big brother. You mentioned that you were you worked for the post office for a while. What, tell us about that experience. And you were an assistant steward in that role as well.
Yeah, I took a summer relief job or a vacation relief job with our local post office in the suburb of Chicago where we lived, Oak Lawn, Illinois. My father had seen a posting for a letter carrier job for summer relief, and he thought it would be a good opportunity. The pay and benefits were excellent, and I was trying to help with costs associated with my college education, trying to help the family out. So I took the job and became a member of the American Letter Carriers first. And I did a one summer stint with the post office, and then enjoyed the work and enjoyed the pay and the benefits. So I transferred to to an indoor facility, a sessional center where they did bulk sorting and processing of mail for the southwest suburb of Chicago, and then transferred to the American Postal Workers Union. That was a different union for the inside workers. And spent about 3 or 4 years there. And during that time, again, somebody approached me and said, "Hey, you don't want to get involved in this union thing?" And so I signed up to be an alternate steward on my overnight shift. But I worked there at the post office on the overnight shift to help put myself through college. And so it was a very good experience. And then when I transferred to Columbia College to start studying broadcast and television, it was when I left the post office and went to work for ABC.
Can I jump in? Maybe I'm shortcutting a question, Jeff, that you were going to ask. I wanted to learn a little bit more about the name Braico, Braico, and your parents' ethnic background. And you said you grew up on the southwest side of Chicago. Chicago is a very segregated city by neighborhood, by race, by ethnicity often. So tell us a little bit about your parents' ethnic background and the which you told us the parish. What was the name of the community and what was its ethnicity?
The parish was Little Flower. The name of the community is I'm sorry to stumble on this. I have to think about wasn't Bridgeport. It was boy, I'm sorry. I'm drawing a blank on the community. I'm more identified with the parish. If it comes to me, I'll come back to it. My father is Italian American. Was Italian American. And he grew up in the near south side of Chicago, what is now Chinatown in Chicago. But when he was a young guy, he was born in 1922. So when he was a young man growing up there, it was predominantly Italian American in that neighborhood, and then Chinese families began to move in. And through his young adolescent life and into his teens before he went to World War II. It was really a blended community of Chinese Americans and Italian Americans, and according to him and the rest of the family, very harmonious. It was a really lovely mix of a neighborhood. It's now predominantly Chinese. It's in fact, it's Chicago's Chinatown, but that's where he grew up. My mother is of Polish American descent. She grew up in the deep south suburbs south of Chicago, in an area called Moments, Illinois. But she was Polish American, and she in her early adult life worked for Johnson and Johnson, making bandages and medical supplies. And then when she and my father married and started a family, she chose to work from home and raise the children and take care of the household. My father's a World War II veteran, and when he came back from the war and married my mother, then he began his own business, but for a while he was a member of IBEW because he worked for a while at the racetrack in Chicago. He was a I guess a bet maker and worked at the betting windows, printing out the betting tickets, and that was an IBEW job. So he was a member of IBEW for a while. When he went on to open his own business, he didn't have an association with a union, so. There isn't a strong, deep connection to unions in my family. A little bit of a connection, but not a very deep connection.
And the Southwest side, that was not people who worked in the steel mills. This was
No.
first, second generation, mostly a white working and middle class neighborhood.
Yeah, very. Yeah, middle class working neighborhood. Lots of different trades. Chicago is one of those cities that requires that city workers, police, fire, streets, and sanitation all reside within the city limits. So the southwest side, the neighborhood I grew up in, were a lot of school teachers, police officers, fire department workers, first responders, manufacturing, blue collar, middle class, some professionals. We had some doctors and attorneys that lived in the neighborhood, but mostly working class. The folks that worked in the steel mills tended to be from the southeast side, which was closer to where to where that work was done. Debbie, you have a connection to Illinois, don't you? Weren't you?
Yeah, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago.
The northern suburbs?
Yes.
Okay, I remember that.
Okay, so you've graduated from Columbia, and do you get hired right away by ABC Chicago?
I was very fortunate in my senior year. They were offering internships at various television stations, and so a couple of the instructors that I had in my junior and senior year at Columbia College were actually directors and producers at ABC Television, and so I got a little bit of a help from them when I applied for the internship. I mentioned to them that I was applying for an internship at ABC, and they helped to put in a good word for me. So my first entrance into professional television was as an intern at ABC early in 1979. And I worked as a sort of a clerical and an intern in the editorial department. Back in those days, television stations, you may recall, used to run editorials where the general manager of the television station or some senior management person would get on and, give an editorial about the price of gas or the transit line or the teacher strike or, something happening in the community. And so I worked in the editorial department for 6 months. And then there was some jobs opening up in technical engineering, which was one of the things I was interested in. And so they hired me as a summer relief, vacation relief camera operator in the studio. And in those days, in the late 70s, it was typical that you'd get hired April through November for the vacation season, and then you'd be furloughed in November. And if you were lucky, you were brought back the next year for another tour of vacation relief work. And, that tended to sometimes happen two or three or four or five times before you got hired permanent. I was very fortunate in 1979 and 1980. There was a huge explosion in electronic news gathering. They were electronic news gathering was sort of outpacing the old film crews in the field, and so there was a big growth at ABC and other television stations in Chicago to bring on more staff. So as my summer tour came to an end and I was about to get furloughed, they offered me a full-time staff job. And so I went really, quite fortunately, seamlessly from the internship to the summer relief job to the full-time job. And, 40 years later, I was still working for ABC in Chicago. So pretty fortunate in my career path.
So talk a little, we haven't interviewed anybody else from NABIT at this point. Talk a little bit about what some of those jobs are like. What is a camera job like in the late 70s, early 80s, and then beyond wherever your trajectory took you in terms of work life?
I have to say it was just terrifically exciting, and I was really very fortunate for the opportunities that came before me. I started out, as I mentioned, as a studio camera person, and even though I had training at Columbia College, a lot of studio and control room training, and they gave us a really broad educational experience. You learn so much more on the job, as I'm sure all of you know and understand. And so I had very good training at the college, and the internship was beneficial. But when I first stepped onto the studio floor and put on the headset and stood behind the camera for the first time as a professional at the top television station in Chicago, it was pretty exciting. So I worked a while as a studio camera operator, and then expanded into other areas: videotape, film projection, audio, sound management, studio lighting, and then started to work out in the field. I got assigned, I think my first second year on the job, I got assigned to Monday Night Football, which at that time was on ABC. You may recall it was the only primetime football show at the time, with folks like Howard Cosell and Don Meredith and Frank Gifford. And so I got assigned to the Sunday Night Football crew, which was pretty exciting. Did some of that, worked in the field for ABC on Wide World of Sports. And then in 1984, I had the opportunity to go to the Summer Olympic Games in Los Angeles and Spent 6 weeks working for ABC there, which led to my first National Emmy Award, or my only National Emmy Award. But the technical crew was awarded an Emmy for technical excellence in 1984 for putting on the Summer Olympics. So, you know, it was those sorts of experiences that you know that really built my career foundationally from 1979 to 1984-85, and then. When I returned to Chicago, I did some electronic news gathering in the field, a lot of field production work, and of course, a lot of studio work, primarily local news broadcasts, and eventually graduated to become a technical director at ABC, which is sort of the top level of the technical engineering crew. You know, when you make it to TD, you've sort of hit the top tier. And so, a really very fortunate, exciting, and fun career path. I had the opportunity to work with lots of different television personalities and politicians over the years, and lots of different broadcasts, sports, news, special events, parades, telethons, you know, really, really ran the gamut. It was pretty exciting.
So talk a little bit more about all that sort of behind it. And I apologize earlier. For years, I've been saying the National Association of Broadcast Engineers and Technicians, and you corrected me today. So you're the first person that's corrected me. I've done it wrong all these years.
Well, I apologize for doing that. I don't
know
somebody of your standing.
I should have been corrected years ago. But talk a little bit more about that work. How you know, you mentioned you were a technical director. So for a lot of us outside of the studio, we may think of those as being supervisory jobs and would be outside of a bargaining unit per se. What was the structure inside the studio in terms of NABIT's representation?
It was supervisory in nature. I'm sorry, can you pardon me 1 second?
Sure.
I just have to step away a quick second. I'm sorry.
Sounds like his AC man might be there.
Yeah, I hope that doesn't mean we hear it blasting. Wow, I want to hear some of the stories about taping an Olympics. What's involved?
Yeah.
My apologies. I'm alone here at the house. The dog was outside, and she was barking to get back in. So I'm the only one here. So I
we were counting on the AC man for you.
No, he'll be coming at some point later. I'm sorry, Jeff, can you repeat the technical director question?
Yeah, just sort of the overall structure in behind the camera in a studio environment.
A typical television crew is, of course, a lot of things have changed with technology and consolidation and automation. But in those days, a typical television crew, you know, was three or four camera operators on the studio floor, a lighting director, some utility folks that would help manage things on the studio floor, hand out microphones, make sure the cable was dressed, make sure that the studio was operating and functioning. And then up in the control room, you'd have an audio engineer who would mix the sound, a director and producer who typically were not in the NABIT bargaining unit. They may have been in other bargaining units, but a director and a producer. There was a teleprompter operator, the teleprompter that, you know, rolls the script for the person reading. The teleprompter job was covered by NABIT at that time. Then you had support people in other areas, editors that would, that would put together the video and the audio for packages. We had videotape playback. We actually had in the early 80s still some film playback. You know, there were still some things shot on film for news. We hadn't converted all of our afternoon and evening movies. You know, you'd see the 10 p.m. movie, the 11 o'clock movie on Saturday night. Those were all still on 16 millimeter film, and those were operated and run by NABIT technicians. People in the graphics department that would type up the lower thirds, you know, Charlie Braco, Jeff Reckenbach, sort of the graphics that you see. So, you know, a whole cohort of people that would contribute to the broadcast. And the technical director, to your point, was sort of a working supervisor, but remained in the bargaining unit. Everybody on the technical crew would report into the technical director, that individuals considered the crew chief. So In the early days when I would work camera, and then they trained me on some audio work and in videotape and out in the field, all of those were building blocks to eventually become a technical director. I was always taught, and I still believe that, to be a supervisor in that capacity, overseeing all of those other job functions and personnel, you have to know a bit about all of those things if you're going to be successful in becoming a supervisor, or in this case, a technical director. So the background that I had and, the opportunities that I had to do those different things was beneficial. And eventually, station management recognized that, and I got promoted to technical director.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. And I do want to talk a little bit about some of these remote assignments that you did with yours and what that would be like. But let me ask you what the evolution of the studio has been like over the past 40 years. I've done a couple of in-studio things here in town with some of the work I've done, volunteer stuff over the past few years. And it doesn't seem like there was an automated camera. Talk a little bit about how that's changed.
Yeah, the automation and the advances in technology have been certainly one of our biggest enemies to the sort of work that I've done and the people that we represent. Probably the earliest iteration of that was the automated cameras, the robotic cameras in the studios. They developed technology where a central control point could drive cameras around the studio floor. In the early days, it was a little bit primitive. It was really a matter of just moving cameras to different positions on the floor. And there was still an operator in the console that would have to frame the shots and set the mm-hmm. shots up. But over time, the automation advanced, and then you could build in a series of templates. So you could have, for any camera or multiple cameras, a single shot of a person, a two shot of the anchors at the desks, a wide shot of the studio. All these things could be programmed into a macro, and at the touch of a button, that camera could fly across the floor and grab the shot needed and, make the necessary adjustments. You might have had to do a little touch up from the robotic operator, but, that really compressed, four jobs into one. Just as soon as that technology was reliable, those four studio camera persons that stood behind the cameras and moved them around and framed the shots, it all went into automation. You had one person, driving that automation. So that was a big change.
What decade was that?
That really started probably in the late 80s, early 90s, maybe 1989, 1990, 91, around that time.
And what was the name of the station, the ABC station in Chicago?
WLS-TV, Channel 7 WLS-TV, ABC 7 Chicago. It's funny, that's sort of another change, not related to the technical aspect, but it used to be both in television and radio, you were always identified by your call letters, WLS-TV, WBBM-TV, and then it started to shift just to the channel numbers. So, even though WLS is still the official call letters, people refer to it now as ABC7.
And you always worked for the local station, never for the national ABC?
I was based at the local station, but was called to duty for network operations frequently. So my work at the Olympics in 1984 was for ABC Sports for the network. I was on assignment many times for ABC News, gathering news in the field, traveling around the country as a two-person news crew, gathering stories. The way the network news is set up is they have bureaus around the country. Chicago was a primary bureau for ABC News, and they would have electronic news crews that would be dispatched all over the Midwest, Des Moines, Iowa, Cleveland, a number of different cities. So I did some work for network news, a fair amount of work for ABC Sports, but primarily the local station was my main employer.
And how were those assignments made? For sending somebody out, for example, to do the Olympics. I mean, obviously, Channel 7 still operating in Chicago while the Olympics are going on. Who decides who goes and who stays?
Yeah, in those days we didn't have, we didn't have what we now call freelance or daily hires. In those days it was all staff employees at ABC. We didn't see daily hires come on the scene until 1992, I believe, was when daily hires first became a thing at ABC. A little bit earlier at NBC, but ABC not until 1990 or so. And so for something like the Olympics, the network had a large staff or a large cohort of staff engineers out of New York, some out of Chicago, many out of Los Angeles that would, do things like Monday night football, golf tournaments, Sunday night baseball. But when something big like the Olympics came along, they had to tap the stations for help so that they could staff up something like the Olympics. And so in 1984, when the summer games were coming, the network called stations like WLS in Chicago and said, "Hey, we're going to need 18 people or 25 people from your station. We'll need five videotape people, seven camera persons, two audio technicians." They'd give them the list, and then local station management would look at the staff at WLS and say, "All right, Charlie does audio. He's not assigned to a regular show. He kind of floats between a couple of shows. Let's send him to the Olympics. We've got three or four camera people that we know do a lot of sports. We'll send those folks to the Olympics. And here's a couple of videotape engineers. We can spare them and backfill other ways." So the request would come from the network for the number of people, and then the station would make the determination. So I drew a lucky straw and got tapped to be audio at the Rose Bowl for national, or I'm sorry, for international soccer games during the Olympics, and got to spend 6 weeks in Los Angeles working for the network.
And so when that happens, are you covered under a national contract, or are you still under your Chicago contract? And how's travel expenses, that sort of thing, arranged?
Yeah, the arrangement between ABC and NABET, similar to NBC and NABET, is we have a master agreement, the collective bargaining agreement that covers our folks at ABC and NBC as a master agreement. So it covers the network operation, news, sports, entertainment, and then the owned television stations are part of that master agreement. So Channel 7 in New York, WABC, the News Bureau in Washington, D.C. Coincidentally, WJLA is not an owned station of the network. It happens to be a NABET shop, but it's not covered by the ABC master agreement. But WLS in Chicago was, KABC Channel 7 in Los Angeles is covered by the master agreement, as is KGO in San Francisco. So the owned stations and the network operations are all part of the master agreement. And when New York called and said, "Send Charlie to, send us some people in Los Angeles," our terms and working conditions were covered by the same agreement, whether we worked at the station or worked for the network. And so that's why there was the ability to move between those operations pretty seamlessly.
So you've done some of these remotes. Did we lose Charlie there?
Yeah, I'm still here, Jeff. I'm
Oh,
sorry. Just
okay. I'm sorry.
trying to,
Nope.
I'm just moving for a second to turn the camera off. Sorry.
No problem. I saw you petting the dog over there on the side, so
Yeah, apologies. The
I no, we're
dog just wanted to go out, so I walked over and let her out the door. I'm
no
sorry for the
problem.
disruption.
It's not a problem at all. It's not a problem. Okay, so you've got this career in the broadcast industry. Talk now a little bit about getting tapped on the shoulder and being asked to become a steward for NABIT.
I'm sure the name's familiar to you. Ray Taylor was it who was the president of NABET Local 41 in Chicago. Although when I met him, he was vice president and grievance chairman. The president of Local 41 at that time was a gentleman by the name of Dan Delaney. So Dan was president, Ray was vice president and grievance chairperson for WLS, and then we had a cohort of stewards. And Mr. Delaney was retiring. And Mr. Taylor was about to move up to assume the presidency of the local. And there was some shifting around in the steward ranks. Somebody had to be promoted to be grievance chairman to fill Ray's spot. So there was some internal movement. And Ray and a couple of people literally cornered me in a hallway one day as I was walking through the studio complex. Said, "Come here, we want to talk to you." And they pulled me over in the corner and said, you know, your union needs you. We'd like you to consider becoming an alternate steward, you know, for the studio group. And I said, well, fellas, that's very nice of you, but I'm pretty busy, you know, starting a family and pretty busy with my career here. I help you guys out any way I can. I'm just not sure that I can make the, you know, the steward commitment. I know there's a lot involved. And they said, well, we know you have a little bit of a background from your work at the Postal Service. You were an alternate steward there. By the way, how they found that out, I'm not sure, but they did. They identified that. So they put the lien on me, if you will. They you know, they reminded me how beneficial being a member of the union was, and I certainly couldn't deny that. And you know, I liked these guys. I was friends with these guys, and so when they ask you to do them a favor, you comply. And so I got involved as an alternate steward for the. For the nighttime studio group, which was the shift I worked most frequently. And then the steward for that group moved on to do something else. And so I shortly thereafter became the steward. And at that point in time, we probably had just shy of 200 NABET technicians at Channel 7 in Chicago. I think we were somewhere in the neighborhood of 185 or 190 technicians in field news operations, studio operations, morning shift, night shift. There was an overnight shift, master control people, videotape, graphics, all of those folks. And we also, and still do, represent news writers and desk assistants and producers on the editorial side. So the folks that work in the newsroom are members of the union. They have a separate contract within the master agreement and different stewards that represent them, but they're all part of the collective of Local 41 at WLS. And so probably nearly 250 members altogether, but 185 or so technicians. And so I was an alternate steward for a brief period of time and then became a full-fledged steward, which gave me a seat on the executive board. Because in Chicago at Local 41, if you're a steward, you are an executive board member. The two go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that representational work for a few years. And then Mr. Taylor tapped me on the shoulder and appointed me to the bylaws committee, which was, to go through and rewrite the local bylaws or amend the local bylaws. And that was a project I really had no experience in, but I enjoyed it immensely. And, so I did some of that work, and you know, one thing leads to another. You're on the mm-hmm. executive board, you're on the bylaws committee, you're on the election committee, and then at some point, you know, somebody put their hand on my shoulder and suggested I run for vice president of the local.
Mm-hmm.
So that's was sort of the trajectory for the,
yeah.
the beginnings in the union.
And just to understand a little bit more about Local 41, did 41 represent all of the network affiliates in the Chicagoland area?
Yes, 41 has ABC WLS, which is an owned, mm-hmm. Which is the station under the ABC master agreement. We also have representation at NBC, which is WMAQ, and they're part of the NBC master agreement, a bargaining unit about the same size. And then a number of smaller affiliate stations and production companies, about 9 or 10 in total at that time. Places like the local Fox station, and mm-hmm. both Spanish language stations, Telemundo and Univision. Mm-hmm. So at that time, I think I want to say in the mid 90s, it was probably 1,200 members at Local 41.
Wow, good size. You're now vice president of the local. What does that job entail? Are you working full time for the local union, or are you still working at ABC? What's that experience like?
Yeah, all of the officer positions at Local 41, with the exception of the president, are part-time positions or on mm-hmm. a stipend. So you continue working your craft job primarily, and then help out the local where you can. And like any vice president, you're at the direction of the president, whatever duties the president assigns you to. Ray, as you may remember, was a terrific leader and a great mentor, and somebody who liked to make sure that the union was going to grow internally with younger people. So mm-hmm. he was very focused on bringing new people into the fold and grooming them and giving them lots of opportunities. So when the next tap on the shoulder came and they asked me to become vice president, And you know, I was successful in that. Ray was terrific in bringing me on board with lots of things: organizing drives, first contract negotiations, grievance meetings, of course, arbitrations. I mean, he really led me along for the 12 years that we were together, and you know, in a really terrific way. And I'm forever indebted to him. He was my mentor and sort of a father figure, you know, through those growth years. But he shared with me every trade secret, opened up all the books, made sure I, you know, that I knew everything and had exposure to as much as possible. And he was very gracious and generous in that way. And then, you know, when he retired, you know, he promoted me to become local president.
What year was that?
2010. So I first became VP in 1998, sort of reluctantly. And there's a whole story behind that. I didn't really want to become the vice president. I was happy in my career job at ABC, and you know, I knew the pressures that Ray was under because we had worked together on a lot of projects, and I knew, you know, I knew what the, you know, what the pressures of the job were. But but I got recruited to be VP and won that election, and then Ray spent the next 12 years grooming me and mentoring me, and so that when he was ready to retire, he wanted to hand it over to me. And again, I was reluctant. I said, "Hey, listen, I'm happy as the vice president. I think I'm doing an okay job in that role. But Ray, I don't want to be the president. I don't want to leave my TV job. I don't want the headaches that you have. We'll find somebody else to be the president. I'll support them fully, but I'm not inclined to take that offer." And he said, "Well, you're the natural choice." I said, no, there's nothing natural about it, my friend. I'll support you in any way I can, but I don't want to be the president." And of course, that didn't last long, and he wasn't going to take no for an answer. So so I'm sorry, Debbie, vice president in 1998, and then local president in 2010.
And are you still technically an employee of ABC7? On leave, or how does that work when you become president?
I had been on leave. Yeah, when I became president, I went on full-time leave. And then just a couple of years ago, you know, obviously deciding I wasn't going to return to television, I exercised my option to retire. And so so with respect to ABC, I'm retired now.
You mentioned one of the tasks that you helped out on was organizing. Can you tell us a little bit about organizing in the broadcast industry in your era?
Yeah, this particular project was the Spanish language, one of the Spanish language stations in Chicago, Univision, which had previously been unrepresented. And the employees there, the workers there, were pretty dissatisfied with their conditions. The other Spanish language station in Chicago, a Telemundo station, was under NABET representation. And so the employees at Univision were comparing, you know, working conditions and salaries and that sort of stuff to their counterparts at Telemundo, and said, "Hey, these folks are doing a lot better and they've got a union. So let's call up these people that, however you pronounce it, NABET, whoever these NABET, you know." And so they contacted us, and of course, Ray was interested and pulled me in right away and said, "I want you to help with this organizing drive." I knew very little about organizing at that point, but I learned a lot. And we worked with that unit and brought them on board and held an election, and we were successful. And then Ray immersed me in the you know, in the initial contract negotiations, so I could see how a new contract, a new collective bargaining agreement, was developed. So that was beneficial and educational. And I'm still very close with that group. It was the first group that I was actively involved in organizing, and the first group that I was able to help deliver a new contract to. And so. So that one, you know, for me is very special.
Yeah, for sure.
And what year was that?
1996.
And by then you're part of CWA, correct?
Yes, we merged with CWA in 93 and 94.
Okay, I'm sure Jeff will ask a lot about that.
Yeah, we'll
in
that.
Terms of the organizing, did the District 4 organizer assist you, or was this all driven by the neighbor local?
We were definitely in contact with District 4 and made them aware. I'm pretty sure Seth would have been the VP at that point.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm sorry, Jeff. I guess
yeah, I was. Seth was my organizing director. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Yeah. Seth later became vice president when you moved on. But yeah, you were VP at the time. I know that Ray and Seth had a close working relationship. So Seth was aware of the organizing drive, but I think we handled it internally for the most part. It was a relatively modest size unit, I think, 40 employees total. We had a pretty good handle on it in Chicago, but I know that we stayed in contact with District 4 and the organizing team there.
You said when in the mid-90s there were 1,200 members in the local. When you took over in 2010, how many?
By that time, we had probably dropped to about 900.
And when you moved on to the NABIT presidency, when you left the local?
In 2015, yeah, I think probably at that point, Debbie, probably 750 or 800. There had been some compression because of some of the automation and some of the changes. So I think, probably when I left the local, in the ballpark of 800 members.
You mentioned earlier that your father was briefly an IBEW member. I seem to recall IBEW making some forays into broadcasting. Is that still an issue out there?
Yeah, they have a toehold. IBEW represents the CBS workers at the CBS network, CBS television network, and at a number of the owned stations. So similar to our master agreement, IBEW has a master agreement with CBS. It's the network operation and several of the bigger market television stations, Chicago being one of them. They also represent workers at Fox Sports nationally. So when you're looking at an NFL game on a Sunday afternoon on Fox, the technicians behind the scenes are IBEW members. So they have a big presence with Fox Sports, FS1, CBS, and CBS Sports. And then they have some affiliate television stations around the country. I'm not sure their overall size, but I would say they're probably comparable to NABIT's, probably somewhere in the 10,000 member range nationally. We compete here and there, but we haven't had the sort of skirmishes that we've had with IATSE, who has a foothold in some broadcast operations, and IATSE and NABIT square off pretty frequently.
Particularly in New York.
New York and nationally, yes. IATSE, has primarily been a theatrical and film union. That's part of their name, the International Association of Theatrical and Stage Employees. So they really started out in stage production, and then expanded into film, motion picture production. And then when the film industry began to change, they wisely set their sights and their goals on broadcast television. And then that's where some of the conflicts with IATSE have come up, is in their efforts to get into broadcast television.
Those membership drops are pretty significant. You talked about it in terms of the automation. Did it also, what were other factors that led to the decline?
I would say the other factors that led to the decline was really the introduction of daily hire and freelance employees at both ABC and NBC in the late 80s and early 90s. As I mentioned before that, if you worked for the networks or you worked for the television stations, you were on staff. There were two categories of employees: full-time staff, and then vacation relief. Which is how I started out. You'd come in and cover vacations, but you were still in the bargaining unit. And then ultimately those jobs led to full time. The networks in the late 80s and early 90s tried to adopt a business model similar to motion picture production companies out on the West Coast. They didn't employ full time staff. They would bring freelance or daily hires on for a project. Whether it was episodic television, a sitcom or a drama show. They weren't in production, full time. And even some of the entertainment shows, you may recall that The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson at a point was really only produced 2 or 3 days a week. Johnny liked to have Monday and Friday off, so it wasn't a full 5-day commitment. They would tape shows, on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, along with the live broadcast, so they could fill a 5-day schedule, but they weren't in production 5 days a week. And so the networks decided to move toward a model where they could employ more freelance or daily hire employees. And that caused a, you know, a reduction in staff. And now I would say NABET is 80% daily hire. And
oh my goodness.
20, only about 20% full-time staff. And so those daily hires don't work every day, and some don't work every month. Some are very seasonal workers. And so that has changed the dynamics of our membership a lot. The automation and the change in employment status, the introduction of more daily hires. And we love and represent our daily hire members. They're an important part of our union, but it has changed the overall makeup and density of our membership base.
Talk a little bit more about what NABET has done to try and improve the situation for daily hires and the obstacles you've faced in doing that.
The daily hire challenges, almost came at the outset. Obviously, when the company changed the model from staff to daily hire, they also tried to change things like benefits and scheduling and pay and those sorts of things. So in the early days, daily hires had very limited, benefits. There was no retirement security. There was no 401k. There was some limited medical benefits. The pay was the same because they were working under the terms of the master agreement. So if you were a daily hire camera operator, you were on the same pay scale as a staff camera operator, but your work commitment was much less. They could use you on 4-hour calls instead of a full 8 hours. They didn't have to, they could employ you 1 day a week or 3 days a week. They didn't have to give you a full-time 40-hour commitment. A number of provisions in the master agreement that covered staff, daily hires were excluded from. So it really was, I hate to use the term second-class citizen, but that's the best parallel I can give. It was a substandard set of terms and conditions, and so that's something that the union NABET has worked very hard over the decades since to give parity to the daily hires, and we've achieved an awful lot of it. Daily hires now have retirement security, a full portfolio of health care. Their benefits and working conditions are very, very parallel to full-time staff. With the exception of the full-time commitment, they're not guaranteed 40 hours a week. But we've made a lot of strides in lifting up the working conditions for daily hires, and we still have some work to do, but. But I would say we're at about 80 or 90% parity now with staff.
And I would guess, given the 80%, that that's now the political pressure at the bargaining table has a lot to do with that.
Absolutely.
Is there a hiring hall kind of an arrangement, or is it just the stations have a call list and they determine who gets hired and who doesn't?
There is no hiring hall structure within NABET. Unfortunately, we can refer people, and we often do. But in hindsight, I think that's probably one of the mistakes we made when we went to the daily hire model. The leadership, the national leadership at that time, didn't want to get involved in the hiring hall structure, and I understand it from the perspective of favoritism and patronage and that sort of thing. They didn't want to get into the weeds on that portion. So they didn't. The employers are really in charge of how they handle the daily hire population. And of course, that comes with its own challenges. I'll just take an example on Sunday Night Football, which is now an NBC property, but still a NABET show. Mm-hmm. The producer and the director and the production team are really in charge of who they hire. And it really is a system of favorites. By the way, they're all very skilled technicians at what they do, or they wouldn't be on that show. But if the producer says, we want Debbie Goldman to be our lead playback operator for slow motion playback, Debbie's going to get the call, and Debbie's going to be on the crew for as long as that director and producer want her there. So that's worked out, fine. But we don't have, you know, we don't have hiring hall control. We can make recommendations and we often refer people, but the hiring of daily hires is in the purview of the employers.
And I guess at the time there was some resentment of the daily hires among the existing. So I'm sure that probably contributed to not wanting to set up sort of formalized structure for bringing these daily hires in. But let me ask you, so evolving off of that, is there within NABIT any kind of a training component for getting daily hires or getting people trained up to the point where they could potentially be a daily hire or even a full-time?
Yeah, we offer training. We've done lots of unique, specific training on particular equipment as new technology comes on the scene, and we want to make sure that our members' skill set is relevant and stays sharp. We offer training. We partnered with CWA Net Academy on lots of different training, and Kevin Salata, who's now in charge of those programs, has been a terrific partner for NABIT. We've done nonlinear editing training in cooperation with CWA Net. More recently, we've done drone training with the, with the flying cameras, the drone cameras. Kevin's been great in those areas. So, yeah, we look to, we take feedback from our members. If there's a technology out there that they're interested in getting trained on, we try to help offer that training. It used to be back in the good old days of television, it used to be that, the companies and the manufacturers would offer the training. If they brought in new camera systems, the company would be responsible for training up the workforce. If it was a new audio console, a new piece of equipment, a new technology, between the company and the equipment manufacturer, there was a lot of training that shifted over the years and, became more of a cost for the company. And so the amount of training got reduced, and that's where the union stepped up and said, we've got to make sure our people keep their skill sets relevant, and so we're more involved in that now.
And is there a way for somebody who's not trained at all to access that training, become a NABIT member in hopes of getting hired?
The short answer is no. Our bylaws require that you work under a collective bargaining agreement for at least one day before you can join the union. Our forefathers didn't want to have a system where people paid an initiation fee to get into the union, and then we couldn't find employment for them.
Right.
Because we're not a hiring hall,
right.
we couldn't offer that second piece. And so we don't want to take somebody's money and give them a union card and
sure.
then not be able to follow through with the job.
Is there an initiation fee?
There is.
That's different than I think a lot of the other units in CWA.
It is very different, and it is a pet peeve of mine. Our financial structure in terms of financial obligation to the union is sort of bifurcated. The dues, the membership dues, are really driven and governed by the sector, by the national organization. But for some reason, Debbie, many moons ago, the initiation fees were the purview of the locals. Pursuant to our national bylaws, initiation fees are determined and managed by the locals. And for many years, we had sort of a standard initiation fee platform, but then over time, many of the locals went to a different model. And so it's a particular problem for us now, especially with the big locals, the network locals in New York and on the West Coast and in Washington. They've been able to manage their initiation fees the way they wanted to. And it's become pretty expensive to become a member in this union. In some cases, on the West Coast and the East Coast, you have to pay essentially 15 days of your salary at your craft rate to join the union, which I think is, I understand that model back when it was all staff and you were bidding to get into a full-time job, or you were taking a full-time job and you were looking at a career track that could go, as a full-time employee over many years. You're going to get a staff job with a guarantee of 40 hours and maybe have a 30 or 40 year career with the network. Then an expensive initiation fee, was more understandable. But with our population now 80% daily hire, to ask somebody to surrender 15 days of their salary just to join the club seems to me, to be excessive.
So are a lot of those daily hires not union? they can still get hired, correct?
A lot of them try to, yeah, they can still get hired. A lot of them try to hide behind the work, the right to work rules in the states that they come from. We have members literally in every single state of the union around the country, even though we don't have locals in every state, because daily hires who work for ABC and NBC and news and sports, you know, might live in Oklahoma. We don't have a local in Oklahoma, but they may get picked up to do work for ABC Sports or NBC Sports. And so, you know, when they're in right to work states, they, you know, they sometimes try to lean on that as a as an avenue around the initiation fee.
But if they're in a non right to work state, then there is a they have to either join the union or pay an agency. Do they have to be in the union in order to work?
Yes. Yeah.
Under something that's covered by the NABIT contract. Okay.
Yes, they have to meet their financial obligation. Even those that are in non-right to work states, we pursue them. I'm sorry. Even those that are in right to work states, we pursue. Because ABC and NBC are both located, the headquarters are in New York City, and that's where these crews are hired and dispatched from. You know, I think, you know, we all understand that the lines with right to work and non-right to work are a little bit blurry. It has to do with where you do the predominance of your work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for the most part, we've been successful in pursuing folks, even if they're in right to work states, by demonstrating that they work for the networks, and a lot of their work is, you know, is done in non-right to work states. They travel around the country, and they're working in California, they're working in Illinois, they're working in New York State. And so if the majority of their work is in normal states, is in good states, they, you know, they have to join the union, or at least fulfill their basic financial obligation to the union. We've had a number of cases where folks have, you know, have claimed that they live in a right to work state and they do most of their work in a right to work state. And if they can demonstrate that, we tend to back off a little bit, but we pursue members who work, daily hire members who work under the national contracts. And I would say in the majority of the time, we're successful, and we have good cooperation from the networks in helping us with that. You know, we have provisions in both master agreements that if you go into bad standing, we can ask that the employer takes you off the employment rolls and put you on a no work list. And NBC and ABC have been primarily cooperative with us in that area.
And is there an accommodation to pay an initiation fee over a period of time, or is it paid up front?
Yes, it's with those bigger price tags on those bigger locals, they do offer payment plans. They offer a discount if you can pay up front. Sometimes they'll knock mm-hmm. off as much as 40% or 50% if you pay up front. So there's an incentive for that. But there are payment plans with all the locals. And these high initiation fees are really become a problem at the big network locals and the big six at NABIT and on the West Coast and the East Coast and Chicago and Washington. A lot of our independent locals in places like San Diego and Buffalo, New York and Cleveland and Erie, Pennsylvania, they have much more modest initiation fees, $50 or $100 to get into the union and then mm-hmm. and then your dues. But the big network locals have been, should we say, more aggressive in their initiation fee. I'd like to see it changed. I'd like to see it standardized. I think it's wrong for us to charge that much money to join the union. I think it's I think it leaves a bad taste in the mouth of a member who's just coming in that they have to surrender that much of their money to join the club and then continue to pay dues. You know, we've gotten a lot of feedback from our daily hires and a lot of pushback about that. And I'd like to see a much more modest initiation fee standardized across, all the locals. But I haven't been successful.
And what is the current due structure for a NABIT member?
1.33% of gross earnings. So different than a lot of other divisions and sectors within CWA, it's 1.33% of your gross, of your total earnings, including all overtime and penalties mm-hmm. and everything else. So it's a fair due structure, I think, to the member. Mm-hmm. I think it's very beneficial to the union. That part of it works out fine.
Very good. So let's turn the clock back a little bit now. You've become vice president of CDB, right? Yeah, right. You're president of Local 41, and from there you're elected as president of NABIT and vice president of CWA. Is that, or was there a half step in between there?
While I was vice president at Local 41 and later, I'm sorry, while I was vice president at Local 41 and up until 2010, I sat on the NABET Sector Executive Council as the regional vice president for Region 4. Mm-hmm. NABET has six regions internally, and Region 4 is the Midwest. So I sat as regional vice president coincidental with my duties as Local 41 vice president. So I had two roles. When Ray retired in 2010, I moved up to become Local 41 president by succession. At the same time, John Clark, and we would remember Jeff was our sector mm-hmm. president, was retiring about a month later. Ray and John both retired early in 2010. So Jim Joyce, who was our national vice president, serving under John Clark as the sector vice president, when John retired, Jim moved up to become sector president. Mm-hmm. And then from the members of the Sector Executive Council, I was elected to serve as Jim's vice president mm-hmm. on the national board. So I ceased being original vice president and became NABET's national vice president. So Jim and I served together. And so from 2010 until 2015, I was the Local 41 president in Chicago and then served as Jim's vice president on the national board. And then Jim, unfortunately, had to go on sick leave in early 2015. He had a rather long period of leave of absence for medical reasons. And so at that time, I had to assume as the acting sector president in Jim's absence. And then when Jim returned from leave in, I think it was May of 2015, he made the decision not to seek re-election, for personal reasons. And so then I ran for sector president and was elected at the convention in Detroit in 2015.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the CWA-NABIT merger. You were still in the local at that point, but can you talk about your experience with that and how that came about and what the perception of the members was when those two unions merged together?
I recall in that period of time, and I was just starting to come into to work for the local in capacity as steward. So I wasn't, I wasn't yet an officer. I didn't get elected as vice president until 98. But I recall in 93 and 94, when the initial discussions about the merger started, there was a good deal of excitement, both at the national level and at the local level. At that time, Jim Nolan was the international president of NABET. John Clark was the national vice president of NABET. Ray Taylor was the president in Chicago. And the prospect of merging with a larger union, especially a large democratic union like CWA, was pretty exciting and well received. Jim Nolan, the international president of NABET, and John were working with Larry Cohn and of course Morty on I think Larry at that point might have been in charge of organizing for mm-hmm. CWA. I think Larry was the initial contact with NABET, but there was a good deal of excitement about about joining with the parent union. The main concern was maintaining NABET's identity and autonomy, and not losing that presence. And so there was a committee formed on the NABET side, comprised of a couple of regional vice presidents, and of course President Nolan and Vice President Clark. To work through and negotiate with CWA over the merger agreement. And there was a point in time, as I recall it, that there was a concern about the autonomy, going away, that NABET would lose its identity. And, mm-hmm. And so there was some internal concern about that. But eventually things worked out. We, at the end of 1993, I believe, executed the merger agreement. And the original merger agreement gave us sort of a one-year period of time to, you know, to get associated and kick the tires and feel things out. And then after that, you know, we were fully a merger partner. Jeff, you probably recall that, you know, in those early days, the president of NABET had a voice on the National Executive Board, but not a vote, because NABET maintained its own secretary treasurer and its own finances. That was part of the original merger agreement, was to NABET would manage its own funds. And, you know, as a result, we weren't part of the CWA budget process. And so John didn't, you know, John didn't have a vote. And then later in the late 90s, I think 98, 2000, in that area, there was a vote by the NABET Executive Council to go into the CWA budget process. And, you know, the NABET Secretary Treasurer then became an assistant to the president. And then John got a full vote on the CWA Executive Board. So there were sort of two steps in the merger agreement, the, you know, the original introduction and honeymoon period. And then later in the late 90s, around 2000, you know, we came fully in with John having a full voice and vote on the board.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Gradually, I think CWA leadership has recognized the value of maintaining the integrity of the identity of the merger partners as a way to help with organizing. I mean, you know, you're much more likely to have residents trying to organize workers at a Telemundo or Univision or wherever it happens to be, if you're talking about NABET versus a more generic CWA. So, and that's true, I think, with AFA and a lot of other merger partners as well. So kudos to NABET for insisting on maintaining that integrity. I think that made a lot of sense. So once you're president of NABET, can you talk about what that has entailed for you? What are some of the great accomplishments and frustrations that you've experienced as president of your union?
The frustrations, I think, just with you know, just with the dynamics in the business, the you know, the seismic shifts that have happened in television and radio broadcasting, you know, the automation that has led to, you know, a fair amount of job loss or consolidation. Technologies that, you know, when I first came into the business, you know, if you wanted to go out and gather news, you put a big heavy camera on your shoulder and you went out and did news gathering, and you had to be pretty specialized in operating equipment like that. And now you've got reporters, producers, production assistants, you know, all sorts of folks, even, you know, even citizens running around with, you know, a television camera and their cell phone. And they're not only able to capture video and edit it, they can transmit it back. And so, you know, that sort of seismic shift in technology and advancement, while it's been cool and exciting, it's taken a hit on what we do, and you know, diminished the value of and the specialty of, you know, of our workforce. You know, when I first started in the television business, people didn't have videotape recorders, you know, in their homes plugged into their TV. There, you know, there was no VHS or Betamax, where they were just coming on the scene in the late 70s and early 80s. And, you know, a videotape machine was a specialized piece of equipment. A television camera was a specialized piece of equipment. And, you know, so producing content, you know, media content for consumption was not something that everybody could do. Now it's something that anybody can do, you know, so that's been a big challenge. And then, you know, supporting our daily hire population in a way that, you know, is meaningful to them is always a challenge. But I'm proud of the accomplishments that we've made at both networks and, you know, in bringing more parity to the daily hires. You know, in terms of accomplishments, I think we've you know, I think we've done a good job, the NABET union, a good job of organizing. We've got a new organizing coordinator in NABET that just came on board a couple of years ago and is having great success. We went for a long, long period of time, about 20 years, without a dedicated organizing director or coordinator. And so we have one now, that person's doing great work. The organizing that we've done in between in those gap years, in that 20 or so years where we didn't have a dedicated person, was really organic. It was, you know, it was driven by the locals picking up a lead here or there or pursuing a lead. And so we had some success in that area, but we've, you know, we've had a lot more We've had a lot more success lately.
What
I'm
is the
proud.
focus? What is the focus of the organizing now?
Really, anywhere there are unorganized workers in broadcaster media, we're trying to organize them. We don't set limits. We're reaching out wherever we can to production companies, television stations, even still radio stations. We just organized a pair of public broadcast radio stations in the Kansas City market. A little bit out of our territory, but we identified the group and were successful in organizing them, and so we'll start to bargain a first contract for them. In terms of other accomplishments, as I said, I'm proud of the work we've done for our daily hires. We've also expanded our reach in sports at both networks, at both ABC and NBC. There were decades where ESPN, which is a subset company within Disney and ABC, ESPN was unorganized and all non-union workers. And in the past 10 years, we've brought thousands of new workers in ESPN under the terms of the master agreement and the sports agreement. We've negotiated with ABC and NBC to pick up more of the cable work. Our primary jurisdiction has always been in over-the-air broadcast and television. We've had less density in cable programming and some distribution, but we've pursued that in recent years, and we've been successful. In NBC, we have we have a large. I'm sorry, is the dog interfering with my audio?
Could be. Something's brushing up. I think with your microphone, maybe.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We're getting a little brush.
Let's see if that's better.
I just wanted to be sure I heard what you said about ESPN, which I think was, in terms of numbers, that probably is one of the biggest achievements. Did you get that through a negotiated agreement with the network that they
Yes.
backed off? It was it neutrality? Was it card check? Was it something else?
It was largely neutrality. It was about 10 years ago. It was 10 years ago. It was the summer of 2014. And we had been trying to organize ESPN, through traditional organizing means for a long time and very unsuccessful. Their main operation up in Bristol, Connecticut, they had really rolled off and, they wouldn't let the union reps in on the shop floor. We couldn't break through the citadel of their main operation in Bristol. And organizing the field workers, they probably had in their Rolodex, if you will, they probably had 5,000 employees all around the country and, in all 50 states, camera operators and slow motion replay operators and utility workers and sound people, in all of these different markets all around the country, and trying to corral those people and organize them was a big challenge. So over time,
Charlie, do you mind maybe trying to take the headphones out? I don't know if it's an issue with the mic. On it,
oh, okay.
But it's just a little muffled.
Is this any better?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Let's. Sorry about that. Let's try this. I don't know what changed, but I'm sorry. Is this better if I talk more loudly?
That's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Let me just adjust my speaker here. Okay, how's that? Okay.
It's good.
Good. Okay. Yeah, Debbie. So, with respect to ESPN, it's been a long journey. As I said, we tried the traditional organizing route. That was very challenging just because of the size of the potential membership base there. So that was a lot harder. But negotiating with ABC and doing the master agreement over the years. In 2014, we sat down with them and said, listen, we really want to represent the folks that work at ESPN, especially when they cross over and do some work on the ABC television network. You may remember a day when ABC Sports was one of the gold standards, things like the Olympics, Wide World of Sports, Monday Night Football, that was all ABC Sports. And ABC Sports was a big division within the network. When Disney bought ABC, they decided to move a lot of that sports programming over to ESPN. And, we didn't have we didn't have representation at ESPN. So we saw more and more of that work drifting away, and we didn't want to lose it. And so we, you know, we continued to pursue it. And so with sort of a neutrality agreement, we chased ABC and Disney to get some of the ESPN work. And we arrived at an agreement where anytime ABC is responsible for crewing and payrolling an ESPN event, we get jurisdiction over that work. So we don't have blanket jurisdiction over all of ESPN, but anytime ESPN and ABC interact, then NABET is involved. And we have a minimum commitment of 35,000 man days or person days at ESPN pursuant to the sports agreement, so that every year, every calendar year, ABC and ESPN have to guarantee us at least 35,000 days of work or more. And we've exceeded that number every year in the last 10 years, so that we have a presence on Monday Night Football, which is an ESPN property, of course, the NBA Finals, the U.S. Open Tennis in Flushing, New York, and lots of other work on ABC. College football is huge for us. Before the sports agreement was negotiated back in 2014, we would get three or four events on a college football weekend because they were hitting ABC network television in the afternoon or on the primetime show in the evening, and maybe a primary ESPN platform. So on a college football weekend, we'd have maybe two or three events, large crews, but two or three events. Everything else that was on ESPN was non-union, non-represented. Once the sports agreement was negotiated in the summer of 2014, and we rolled into the college football season that year, the explosion of work that was NABET represented was almost too much to keep up with. We went from two or three events to 8 or 10 events every Saturday, nearly tripling the amount of work we did for the network. And so the explosion was terrific. It was the sort of thing where all of these folks that had been working non-union on these ESPN platforms suddenly were exposed to NABET and suddenly had to get signed up with NABET. So that was very beneficial. That work was very beneficial, and it continues to expand today. And that's why I say we brought in thousands of new members, through that arrangement with ESPN and ABC.
And what's the situation at CNN?
CNN, we don't represent workers at CNN currently. There was a period of time you may be familiar with. There was a subcontractor in Washington, D.C. called Team Video Services. And they had an arrangement with CNN to supply news crews in the Washington, D.C. market and in New York, where they would hire freelance news camera operators and audio engineers and then feed them into the CWA system. NABET organized Team Video Services. We did an organizational drive there and executed a collective bargaining agreement so that any employees of TVS, Team Video Services, were NABET represented. And by extension, when they worked for CNN, they were covered by that collective bargaining agreement. At some point in the early 2000s, around 2002, 2003, CNN terminated its relationship with Team Video Services. They canceled the contract, said, "We don't need you to perform crewing services for us anymore. We're going to take all of that work in-house." Those folks who work for Team Video Services are welcome to apply for jobs with CNN, and we'll evaluate them, individually, but there's no guarantee that we're going to hire all of them. And so they terminated the contract with Team Video Services, the relationship between CNN and TVS. And of course, we challenged it and said, "Hey, wait a minute, this is NABET work, and we've had this long history," filed charges at the National Labor Relations Board, and stayed in the fight for 17 years until we finally prevailed back in 2020 and won that landmark settlement of $74 million, where CNN had to settle that case and give back pay to those workers that were adversely impacted by that action. And so that's another thing I'm proud of, that NABET stayed in that fight. There were many steps along the way where we could have, released from that litigation and thrown our hands up and said this is not worth pursuing. But you know, under John's administration, Jim's administration, and I tried to carry on. You know, I tried to carry on the fight. We were successful in, you know, in staying in that game and got, you know, most of those people made whole in one way or the other. Some of those discriminatees came out of that litigation with really life-changing money. Some of the back pay awards were in the high hundreds of thousands of dollars. A couple of people got very close to $1 million in back pay. So it was a long, brutal fight, but in the end we prevailed. And I think that $74 million settlement is one of the largest in NLRB history.
Kudos. And during the brief moment that AT&T and Time Warner were together, there wasn't an ability to get any kind of neutrality down at CNN?
No.
Okay. I know that that romance didn't last long, but I was hopeful when that came about that that might be the case.
No, in fact, we tried to extend the neutrality agreement to some DirecTV units out on the West Coast.
Right.
You know, as you're well aware, Jeff and Debbie and Hannah, the DirecTV field technicians are represented by CWA in lots of markets. The broadcast centers were not, and so we identified two broadcast centers in Southern California about 5 or 6 years ago, seven years ago. And started to organize those folks and started to negotiate on their behalf. But AT&T would not extend the neutrality agreement to the broadcast centers, and so we had a fight that fight in the traditional way. Ultimately, dissatisfied with the progress we were making, those units finally filed for desert, and we don't have them anymore. But that neutrality agreement that extended to DirecTV field workers, they would not recognize the broadcast workers. So that was a bit of a disappointment. We tried hard, but in the end, we were unsuccessful.
We talk about how this industry has changed. Can you talk a little bit more about the impact that cable and streaming has had on the work you're doing now?
Yeah, sure. It's as I said, it's been challenging. We've made some good inroads. ESPN's a great example. Mm-hmm. NBC Sports, that now is has its own streaming and cable channels. Things like the Olympic Channel and USA Network, and of course Peacock. Those are all avenues where we don't we don't extend full ironclad jurisdiction. So we've had to pursue different arrangements. We also don't, our jurisdiction with the two networks is also limited to the United States. And so when the Olympics are overseas, or the British Open is overseas, we have to pursue the networks and work out project agreements to make sure that that work is union represented. And we've been largely successful with NBC. The Olympics are covered by NABET jurisdiction. The British Open, or the Open Championship, as they call it, coming up later this month, will be a NABET show, even though it's going to be held over in Scotland. We've had some penetration into cable and streaming, and it's getting better all the time. But there's an awful lot of, there's an awful lot of cable networks and streaming platforms out there that, that we haven't had to, that we haven't been able to embrace as, as union operations. And so we continue to try to pursue that. But it's very diffuse. You can think about hundreds of different streaming platforms and streaming channels and cable channels out there, and trying to organize them and make them union is a challenge, but one that we pursue where we can.
And so Univision, is that owned by NBC?
No, Telemundo is.
Telemundo is, yeah, NBC.
Telemundo is owned.
And so is when they cover a sporting event, are those our technicians as well doing the Telemundo work?
Some of it is. If it's local in one of the markets that we represent, it's absolutely our work. If it's national, by extension with NBC, some of that work ends up in our hands.
Do you miss being a technician, covering some of these events?
I absolutely do. I get the trembles even today when I walk into a television control room or production truck at a sporting event. And I see the equipment, especially the equipment I used to operate. I want to jump back in and start doing it. Sorry, the technician is calling. I'll step away from that. I'm sorry.
Okay, sure.
What was I going to say? I know there was a lot of push to try and connect NABIT with the cable organizing, and I don't think that really happened.
No, I don't think it did either. And I think
not that that was that successful, but.
But I also think, and you know, this would have been more interesting with a John Clark. At the time of the merger, I think the notion that Morty and Larry had was bringing all of the entertainment unions together. And so IATSE and, I think they were in discussions with them as well.
And SAG-AFTRA. And,
SAG-AFTRA.
Well, they were SAG and they were AFTRA
right,
then.
Right, right. So we were going to be the umbrella for all of those. And NABIT was sort of the linchpin, the first one. And you know, we were going to hope to parlay that into bringing the other unions in as well.
Obviously, and that never happened.
No. I know there were discussions with SAG and AFTRA, and those were pretty extensive, but never really came to fruition, unfortunately.
I remember one year when I was chairing the resolutions committee. This was still when Dina Beaumont had the rule that you got your per diem at the highest rate of the person on your committee. And so
everybody wanted a NABIT person on the committee.
Yeah,
absolutely. I remember well.
Because they were making, this is 10 years ago, they were making $100,000 plus.
Right. And, you know, because of the travel they did for work, their per diem rates were pretty good. I mean, they were, yeah, it was. Yeah,
I'm curious to ask him, though, whether they've been successful to get women and people of color in the leadership.
My apologies. Thank you so much. I'm sorry to have to step out a couple of times. Between the dog and the air conditioning repairman, it's been a little chaotic here.
But oh, he's there. Great. Congratulations.
Thank you. And I apologize for the interruption.
Not a problem. So we were just talking. One of the things we'd like to talk a little bit about is the role of women and people of color in NABIT and how that has progressed over your career. I mean, I'm sure you've seen some pretty dramatic changes as I did in the telephone industry. Over my time there.
So, yes, yeah, absolutely. Significant, important, in most cases too late, but the changes have occurred. When I started in the business, back in the late 70s, it was male dominated, frankly, both in front of and behind the camera. Over time that's changed and improved a great deal. But, I know that when I came into the technical ranks, there were some women in advanced positions. We had a couple of ENG photographers out in the field, but not very many. And in the studio operations, women were mostly relegated to keyboard type jobs, the character generator that puts the names on the screens, or the graphic arts devices that have keyboards associated with them. I guess that's a link to the old days of typewriter keyboards and clerical work, but there was definitely a barrier for women in the broadcast business, and certainly in the 60s and 70s it began to change in the late 70s, and I'm happy to say that it has really accelerated over the last few decades, but there was a barrier there. And for a woman to achieve a senior position like senior audio engineer or technical director was rare, and not always met, with a great deal of enthusiasm. I remember in Chicago at WLS, the station I worked at, all of the technical directors were men. There was a very skilled, very talented woman who worked her way up through the ranks and demonstrated her skills. And she was eventually, promoted to be a technical director, at least on a part-time basis. And there were some guys on the crew that resented that, didn't want to have to take orders or report to a woman. And it was, you know, shocking and disturbing to a lot of us who had a more progressive mindset. But that was part of the culture. And I can remember, you know, some of these camera guys gathered around in the break room saying, you know, I don't know what's going on around here, but, you know, we've got a woman in, you know, at the TD position, and I'm not going to take instruction from her. So there, you know, there was unfortunately some of that. And I think in terms of, you know, persons of color, there were, you know, there were some problems in that area as well. Most of that has washed away, and we, you know, we don't see that anymore. You know, both in front of the camera and behind the camera, there's a great deal of diversity. It's long overdue. But there was a, you know, there was a dark chapter there when it wasn't, mm-hmm. when it wasn't as open and progressive in our business.
So do you have a sense of what the makeup is today? Of membership?
You know, I don't, Jeff. We, you know, mm-hmm. we'd have to look at it. I'm sure we could do some research, but I would say by and large, it's, you know, it's pretty balanced. There are lots of females and people of color in senior leadership positions, station managers, vice mm-hmm. presidents at the network, vice presidents at the stations. You know, in ENG photography, it's a, you know, it's a pretty balanced mix, men, mm-hmm. women, people of color, studio operations out in the field for sports. Sports production is, I would say, probably still is, you know, if you went out and saw a, you know, a football crew or a golf crew, it's probably still mostly men, at least a higher percentage of men than women. But the, you know, the sort of technical barriers on the different skill sets on the different jobs has washed away. We've got female producers and female directors and technical directors and people in senior positions. So it's getting better. I think there's still always room for improvement in those areas, but much, much better than it used mm-hmm. to be.
What about within NABIT, among local presidents, vice presidents?
I think we're very diverse, you know, across all platforms. Our general counsel is a woman, Judy Chartier, a general counsel for NABIT, is a female. We have a number of female leaders in as local presidents. You know, we participate in the Women's Committee and the CRE Committee. We have seats on both of those. Lots of local presidents, local officers. Stewards, you know, representatives all over the place. I'm pretty pleased with the diversity within NABIT.
People of color also are.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, we have sort of a tradition in these. We ask Hannah to ask a question. Somebody who has nothing to do with CWA, other than this particular project. And she tends to come up with the questions that that Debbie and I, because of our biases, would miss. So Hannah, what have you got for us today?
Sure. I was just curious, Charlie, you spoke about when you were kind of rising up in the union and becoming the local vice president and the local president, that you had some reluctance. And I'm wondering, you know, either becoming vice president or president, what was it that changed your mind?
It's a great question. You saved the tough ones for the end, Jeff and Debbie. you know, I think, Hannah, to be honest, it was a combination of things. One was I was really having so much fun in my television, in my career job. You know, doing television production in the studio or in the field is really exciting. You get to meet a lot of interesting people. You get exposure to a lot of things that, you know, you might not otherwise have. You know, when I was doing sports, it was sort of the behind the ropes access that I had, whether it was a football stadium or a baseball park or a golf course. You know, you get exposure to things that, you know, that you wouldn't get as a, you know, as a viewer or as a, you know, as a spectator. You get some really interesting opportunities. And, you know, the sort of work we do, especially in live television, I think live broadcast probably excited me and stimulated me more than, you know, than other forms of television. But just it was really exciting to, you know, to work on these shows and to be a part of these shows. And so the sort of charge I got every day out of, you know, producing live television, whether it was sports or news or entertainment, was great. And, you know, I saw the union work is, you know, is more, I don't want to say a desk job, but more of a, you know, more, more sort of routine work, and certainly a lot more involved and a lot more time consuming. The beauty of live television is you prepare for the show, you execute the show. There's a huge adrenaline rush, when you're live, and then when the show goes off the air and it's been successful, there's a great feeling of accomplishment, and then you put that one to rest and you move on to the next production. So that sort of excitement drove me, and my observation of the union stuff was it was much more labor intensive. Negotiating a contract, organizing a group of workers, pursuing a grievance or an arbitration was a lot of it was a lot of frustration, a lot of heavy lifting, a lot of thinking, a lot of headaches. And so I think for me, the excitement and fun of television was more attractive than the nuts and bolts of union work. But that changed, once I really got involved in the union work. And I think what really changed it for me was helping people out, resolving a problem for somebody, resolving a workplace issue, an overtime issue, a problem with the crew, somebody who was eligible for benefits that wasn't getting the benefit, somebody whose pension was calculated improperly, and we were able to change that and really make a significant change in somebody's life, awarding some family a union sponsored scholarship and seeing them be able to put a child through college. Those things that that are real world and maybe weren't as flashy and as exciting as as producing a football game, but meant something in somebody's life. The fruits of the labor of pursuing that sort of thing paid off. And even though contract negotiations, whether local or on a national scale, can be frustrating and really hard work, when you come out on the other end and you achieve a good contract, that was rewarding. And so those things changed my perspective. I don't know if that's entirely responsive to your question.
No, but it is. I'm wondering if you have maybe, you mentioned a bunch of examples of ways that the union made a difference in people's lives. And I'm wondering if you have maybe like a favorite story that really exemplifies that you'd like to share.
Well, the CNN story, even though it was a very long path to get there, the CNN story in the end became, became one of those things that you can really hold up and be proud of, because it, it really changed, a lot of people's lives in a positive way. Some of those folks that were laid off by CNN and Team Video Services in 2003 never went back into the business, right? They, they got laid off and they ended up going into an entirely different business, and in many cases didn't have the same career and didn't make the same sort of money. And so when we were able to land, settlements that put tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars into the pockets of people after, after a 15-year battle, that was very rewarding. And then, things like ESPN, negotiating those first sports agreements that brought all of those people who had previously not been represented by a union and didn't enjoy the full benefits of, didn't enjoy the full benefits of, what the union had to offer in terms of pay and benefits and things like that. We were able to negotiate those. There was initially a little bit of pushback by some of those people. What, what's this? I have to join the union. I have to pay dues. Why is that? I'm fine. I'm a freelancer. I set my own rate with ESPN. But when they realized that they were getting 401k contributions and they were getting a benefit, a health and welfare benefit package, and they were getting increased pay, and if they didn't get their lunch on time, there was a penalty against the company, and they got better travel pay, they got better conditions, those people came back to us and thanked us. And so that sort of stuff is rewarding when we're able to achieve significant improvements for people. That that pleases me, and it's rewarding.
I just have one more question, which is, you mentioned your mentor Ray. Do you have any stories you'd like to share about him or your relationship? Any moments where he really inspired you?
I could spend another couple hours talking to you about Ray Taylor. And by the way, Ray is still around, and he was pretty involved in those early days in the merger agreement with CWA and Jeff. I know Ray mm-hmm. well.
Yeah.
He is just a man of great integrity, very selfless, loved, like me, loved the broadcast side of the business. He worked at ABC. In fact, he started at ABC as a studio and field technician, the same job I started at, the year I was born, 1957. He walked through the doors of ABC and, you know, remained working there until he became the full-time president of NABET in 1997, I guess, when he, 1995, 97, anyway. His integrity, his love for the business, but his passion for people and his gold standard of always trying to do the right thing. He always wanted to make sure that no matter what we were doing, negotiating with the company, resolving a grievance, representing a member, organizing a new group, negotiating a first contract, any of it was always done with integrity and balance. And, he taught me early on, he said, in this game of labor relations, you have to be mindful of something, and that is your word is your bond. When you make a commitment to a business partner, even if it's an adversary, even if it's a labor relations attorney across the table or a vice president of a network, when you make that commitment that the union is going to enter into this bargain, you hold up your side of the deal, and you never stray from that. Pardon me. It's one of the standards that he taught me, and he exemplified it, every day in what he did. And I've known, frankly, a lot of people in leadership roles within the union that haven't comported to that same standard. Ray did, and so I think that's one of the takeaways for me, in learning from him was, integrity and professionalism. And always keeping to your word, and just really being true to the mission, is something that he taught me. And of course, a strong work ethic. He wasn't a 9-to-5 guy. He was available after hours on the weekends, and always made sure he was there for the members. He'd take a phone call at any time. He'd take a meeting with a member at any time. And I guess the other piece that was so important for me was there were no secrets between Ray and I, whether I, in my capacity as a steward and e-board member, later as his vice president, he opened up every book and showed me everything. There was nothing that he kept behind the scenes. There was no secret that, he wouldn't share from me. He gave me all the tools of the trade.
Thank you.
Well, we've asked you for 2 hours and we're running a little bit over that right now, but you've mentioned a couple times that in your job in the studio in particular and out in the field, you've run into lots of interesting and famous people. So I have to ask you, give me the top five that you would put in that category.
Barbara Bush was one of them. You're talking about people in the business or outside of the business?
No, it was just who you would categorize as particularly interesting or famous that you encountered as a result of the work.
Yeah, I'd say Barbara Bush, Barack Obama, of course. Barack, we did some television shows and some productions with Barack. In fact, I remember when he was still a state senator in Illinois, he was in the studio for one of our talk shows, and he was obviously, it might have been after the... might have been after the 2004 convention. I think he was a keynote speaker in 2004. But he was certainly, he was certainly rising to prominence on the national stage, even though at the time he was just a state senator. And he was doing a talk show segment, a political show at our station. And after the show was over, he was leaving the studio with his wife. And there was a gaggle of news cameras and reporters around. And they were very aggressively, asking him questions. And there were 8 or 10 reporters, cameras, microphones. It was kind of chaotic. And he was very polite and balanced about it all. But Michelle was less happy about it and sort of scolded the press for being in their face all the time and not giving them any privacy. And she was a little bit exercised about it, but he handled it with grace and answered all the questions and they went off. But I remember she was a little agitated. And then, of course, he went on to become a United States senator and ultimately the president. So certainly he was one of the great ones that I had the opportunity to meet. Al Michaels, you know, who's the was the voice of Sunday Night Football, is now the voice of Thursday Night Football. Pretty remarkable guy. Enjoyed working with him. Howard Cosell for different reasons. Howard was an interesting character. Not always the gold standard of integrity, but he was an interesting big guy to work with. But I would say those are a few of my top four or five.
Yeah. Very cool.
Quick funny story. Barbara Bush, part of the reason I got a chance to meet her was we were doing an Oprah Winfrey show with her at one point, and she was coming to the Chicago studio. I believe they were out of office. I guess they were still in office, so she was still the first lady. But in any case, she had a full Secret Service, you know, contingent around her as first lady. And when they, you know, when they booked her for the show, they identified who the crew was going to be because we all had to have background checks, and the studio had to have a Secret Service suite the day before, and you know, all of the security measures that go around. And so the day of the show, they've got Secret Service agents in plain clothes in the audience. You may recall the Oprah Winfrey show was a live audience, and so, you know, live studio audience. So they had a couple of Secret Service plants in the audience, and they had Secret Service folks in the wings and metal detectors to get people in. And even in the control room where the director and I were working, there were a couple of Secret Service agents in the control room, even though Mrs. Bush didn't come into the control room. And I remember in pre-production for the show, the director and I were putting together a couple of promos for the affiliate feed about 5 or 10 minutes before the show. And it's a pretty exciting time. The director's calling it out, stand by camera one, roll the tape, camera two, you know, all this sort of excitement in the control room. We're doing our job and, you know, managing all of that sort of electricity as you lead into the live show. And when we took a brief break before we went on the air, the Secret Service guy standing behind me leaned over my shoulder and he said, "Man, you've got a really stressful job." And I looked up at him. I said, "What?" He said, "Your job is really stressful." And I just laughed at him. I said, "You're protecting the life of the first family, and you think what I'm doing here, pressing a few buttons and making a TV show, is stressful?" He said, "Yeah, buddy, I couldn't do what you're doing." I just found that very humorous. The, you know, the perspective of looking at somebody else's job and thinking that's more stressful than what I do. I always found that one funny.
Well, that's a great note to wrap it up on. I can't tell you how much we appreciate you giving us these couple of hours today, Charlie. It was really been fascinating and delightful. So thanks for doing it.